Good morning. The first case on the docket this morning is United States versus Boyce. Are the parties ready? Okay, we'll hear first from the appellant.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is James Trishman, and along with Captain Annie Morgan, we represent the appellant, Senior Airman Rodney Boyce. The Chief of Staff of the Air Force committed actual and apparent unlawful command influence when he threatened to fire the convening authority for appropriately exercising his lawful judicial functions in sexual assault cases.
Counsel, before you get fully started, I just want to be able to make sure that I understand the contours of your argument. Let's say that the Secretary directly called Lieutenant General Franklin. How would that affect your argument about UCI in this case?
In that case, Your Honor, whether or not the Secretary of the Air Force directly had the authority to remove him or not, at the very least, the context of apparent UCI would still exist. I mean, in a reasonable member of the public, anyone in the command, a superior position, who ordered General Franklin to fire or retire, certainly would look like that he's being influenced based on his prior decision to sexual assault cases.
Well, a service secretary is not a commander.
Well, to the extent
he has no command authority. He's not in the line of command.
Well, in this case, it was the chief of staff that ordered.
But my question is
hypothetical. If the service secretary had done this directly,
how do you get around 37A when it refers to someone subject to the chapter engaging in this conduct?
Well, certainly, I mean, the code says subject to the chapter, but at the very least, the unlawful command influence, the position of authority the secretary has over other superiors, such as the chief of staff in this case.
But my hypothetical to you is the secretary calls directly. 37A refers to a person subject to the chapter. Under that scenario, how would you find unlawful command influence?
I think the simple answer to that, Your Honor, is it'd be apparent unlawful command influence. A reasonable member of the public
would
not be able to.
Okay, but what is that founded on? Unlawful command influence sounds in the code, correct? Not in due process, not in Constitution, not in anything else. Even apparent UCI. Isn't it based on 37A?
Your Honor, I think you'll find throughout the case law there's many instances where this court doesn't strictly adhere to the language, you know, a commander or superior. For instance, they found SJAs commit unlawful command influences. There are instances where this court does see the act, just, you know, not from the strict language of the code, but the actual position of authority exerted. They've somehow influenced the case. And I think the example of the SJA is an example.
So if we untether it from 37A, where do we stop? Commander-in-Chief, unlawful command influence? What about Chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee says, I will not hold hearings on any officer who wants to become or is nominated to become a two-star or three-star if that person hasn't done what I think they ought to have done in regard to sexual assault cases. Do we then, as a court, say unlawful command influence?
Well, obviously, you know, you're asking a hypothetical. These cases are so fact-specific that, well, obviously, in this case, that decision doesn't need to be made, and it would just have to. You
but doesn't
the fact to see how it would flow, you know, was it his commander, you know, is it in this case, as in this case, was the commander influenced to give that order to someone? Whether or not, and in this case, we're not asking for to open up the floodgates, right?
But the chief of staff here, in this instance, in the organizational chart, he's not a commander. When he spoke to Lieutenant General Franklin, he didn't say, I've lost confidence. He said the secretary has lost confidence. His email to Franklin was, hang in there. Later, when Franklin calls and says, I want to retire, the chief of staff doesn't say, okay, fine. He says, okay, I'm going to be talking to the secretary at some later point. So doesn't it matter here about whether the chief of staff was simply a conduit for information from the secretary as compared to whether the chief of staff was doing something on his own or had some authority to do something on his own?
You can put lipstick on this and make it look like something else that it's not, whether he was a conduit or not. I mean, just look exactly what happened, though. I mean, even General Franklin says that in his affidavit, you'd be foolish to think that, or naive to think that the public wouldn't think this is unlawful command influence.
But then he also says later there wasn't.
That's so, actual, Your Honor, right.
So can we say we'll accept partly what Lieutenant General Franklin has said about this issue, but not everything he said about this issue?
In that case, Your Honor, and what we've been planning to address is that he personally says that he wasn't influenced. And that's, you know, his actual influence. But what I'd also have this court turn its attention to is United States versus Gilbert, which involved a letter to a commander, to the commanding authority, a civil letter stating he didn't think his actions would achieve his goals. In that case, the commanding authority said, I re-examined my position. And this court found unlawful command influence. That's exactly what happened here. The convening authority was given the threat, whether to fire or retire, and to be fired or retire,
Mr.
and it just influenced him.
Let's get right to the point here. I think maybe what, and I don't want to speak for Judge Olson, but the pointed question is, can the Secretary of the Air Force commit unlawful influence on the military justice system, notwithstanding the fact that she may not be subject to Article 37? That's the question. At least that's the question I have.
Yes, Your Honor. And once again, at the very least indirectly, at the very least making a statement or telling the chief of staff that it influences his decision.
Well, I'm not asking about any conduits. I'm saying because the record suggests that the chief of staff was simply conveying the desires of the Secretary of the Air Force. So my question is exactly as I've stated it, which is, can the Secretary of the Air Force be found to have unlawfully influenced the military justice system, notwithstanding the fact that she may or is not subject to the code under Article 37? That's my question.
But yes, Your Honor, my response is absolutely. Given her nature of authority, she could have unlawful influence.
Counsel, let's take it to another remove of generality. In a constitutional system that is based and has been based for 200-plus years on civilian control of the armed forces and the political neutrality of the armed forces, where do you draw the line on elected or appointed senior civilian officials making statements about the military justice system or individual cases, given the premise that they're in control and the premise that the armed forces are and must be politically neutral? That's a philosophical question. I'm not necessarily tying it to your case.
Yes, Your Honor. And to answer the question is where you draw the line. In this case, one of the facts we argue there's UCI is there's a direct nexus in this case. The nexus of the class of case plus the time, the temporal proximity of General Franklin being.
I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the question isn't whether General Franklin could have been subject to UCI. I think the question is whether if the people that did whatever would have caused him to feel influenced aren't subject to the code, can they commit UCI? Is that?
Well, and it's broader than that because the whole premise of the system is civilian control, And politicians normally exercise control by making public statements, among other things. I'm really wondering where, even if we agree with you, where you draw the line. I mean, the president can convene a general court. He's not subject to code, but he can convene a general court-martial. He has the authority under the code to convene a general court-martial. Can he therefore commit actual or implied UCI? I don't know where we go with this if we buy your premise.
Well, the unique circumstances of this case, and one of my goals is not to take us out to decide whether or not the president can today.
I realize you'd rather just stay away from that, but that's what I'm that's what I'm asking. If you don't want to answer the question, that's fine.
I would just have to say it, when it comes to these UCI cases, it's so fact specific. And, you know, the president in his role as commander in chief, could he do something that interjects itself in the court martial process or order a commander that then is a conduit? And that often happens as well. I mean, in this case, at the very least, the chief of staff is a conduit, and hypothetical aside, it did have an effect on General.
What you're saying is there is, in your fact-bound case, we don't need to reach that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, fair enough.
But we only don't have to reach that if we conclude that the chief of staff was really an actor in this case rather than merely a conduit.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And I believe the facts show that not only would a reasonable person believe he was, but he was actually influenced. General Franklin's affidavit, he did things differently, just like in Gurlitch, that he wouldn't have.
But what would be different from the chief of staff delivering a letter from the secretary to Lieutenant General Franklin saying, "I've lost confidence in you. Retire or be fired"? Why is he a different conduit? Why does that?
At the very least, I mean, there's still the argument for apparent UCI in that case. I mean, what
so
is
delivering
happening?
The letter would still
right.
be apparent?
You're looking at what General Franklin's response is to the position he's in. Could this court find that he's just not the Secretary of the Air Force, doesn't have, is completely removed from UCI, and he could deliver a letter and it not be UCI? It could, but that's not the situation in this case. The situation in this case is the chief of staff's actions and General Franklin's response and the perceived influence of be fired, we're going to fire you, or retire.
Mr. Trishman? Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, John.
You seem to be resisting the notion that I kind of raised earlier, which was the question of whether or not the secretary is the influencer here. You seem to be resisting that. And you want to continue to maintain that the chief of staff is the bad guy here. Why is that? Why would you not be willing to accept the notion or the premise that the secretary is the one doing the attempted influencing, so to speak?
Yes, Your Honor. And to be clear, I'm not fighting against that at all. Mm-hmm. It's just, once you get under the facts of this case, if that was my only argument, it would be very different, because we're getting into, hey, is a civilian subject to the code? And these more of the fiscal...
Well, we know that that she's not subject to the code. I think most people would accept that. The question is, can she influence
the
system notwithstanding that?
And that opens up the door. The only reason why any type of pushback.
It opens up the door that Judge Stuckey.
It opens up this whole door that's really unnecessary to find that there was unlawful influence in this case and to dismiss the charges. In this case. Otherwise, I'm going down the road of,
which civilians might be.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or might be influencers. So
right. And then in the midst of that, what happened here gets lost.
But if we acknowledge Judge Stuckey's concern, does this case have to reach that threshold that Judge Stuckey set out of worrying about the people all the way up to the president? Do we have to address the issue all the way up the chain of command to the president in this case if we were to, well, let me say if one were to accept the fact that the secretary is the accuser here and not the chief of staff?
Your Honor, I see him every time.
You can certainly respond to the question.
Your Honor, once again, I would just be right. I don't think it's necessary to get to answer the question today whether or not the president can commit UCI. Mm-hmm. And I stick to that more because the facts of this case has the actual command, has a command subject to the code. There's no argument about that in it.
I understand.
Save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
We'll hear from you on rebuttal. Thank you. We'll now hear from the government.
Thank you, Chief Judge Erdman. May it please the court. I'm Major Thomas Alford, and along with Colonel Catherine Oler, we represent the United States in this case. Time and time again, Lieutenant General Franklin demonstrated that he was unmoved by any top-down, improper influence. What did move General Franklin was advice that came from the bottom up, advice from his squadron and wing commanders, advice from Article 32 investigating officers, and the advice of his staff judge advocate. So when the preferring commander in this case, the Article 32 investigating officer, the special court-martial convening authority, and his staff judge advocate all recommended referral, General Franklin listened. Moreover, by the time General Franklin exercised his own independent judgment in referring charges in this case, he had nothing to gain or lose professionally.
Yeah, the government has this theory that no one would be more bomb-proof than Lieutenant General Franklin, because he's about to retire. His career is ruined because of actions he took in prior cases. And that therefore, he's essentially beyond the specter of UCI. He's floating up there in the ether somewhere. Couldn't he have been hauled before the Senate Armed Services Committee and yelled at by members thereof? Couldn't he have been subject to some sort of strange IG action, which seems to be a common occurrence in the Air Force? Couldn't they have done a grade determination on him and decided that he should be a colonel in retirement? There's all kinds of stuff that could have happened to him. The notion that the government's peddling that somehow he's above it all because his career's already been ruined seems a bit dubious.
Well, Your Honor, that's not just the government's position, but that was also the military judge's finding. But I would agree with you that General Franklin is not completely immune to unlawful command influence. But
no, not completely immune from consequences simply because
either.
His career's already ruined.
That's right, Judge Stuckey, and I would agree, not consequences either, but the facts of this case are that there was effectively nothing else that they really could do, I mean, short of your examples, but there was no indication that they wanted to do that. But the most important...
Who's they?
Well, they, anybody above General Franklin. There's
well,
no
I mean, he gets a call from General Welsh saying, the Secretary's lost confidence in you, you're fired unless you retire as a two-star. That's kind of a slap with a wet fish, isn't it? You think that's something that might just maybe have an eensy-weensy little bit of effect?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
I don't think so.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because if you look at...
He denied it had an effect, which, as was pointed out, that goes to actual UCI. What about the appearance of this thing?
I think it goes to both, Your Honor. And it's also important to consider when he said that. When was his affidavit? This was already after he had begun his terminal leave. So effectively, really, what else was there that was going to happen at that point?
But kind of building on what Judge Stuckey was saying, You've got the Secretary of the Air Force saying, okay, I'll grant your wish, I'll permit you to retire. But there was an understanding out there, I'm sure, it would certainly appear in the mind of Lieutenant General Franklin, that any action he took in regard to future courts-martial would be examined. And if he started to not go along with the recommendations as it came up through the pipeline to proceed with court-martials, at that point he would look very petulant and could have easily caused the Secretary of the Air Force to say, guess what? The bargain's off. You're not going to be retired. You're going to be fired.
Well, Your Honor, SECAF has the ability to assign officers one way or the other, but the fact like that she could dismiss him from the service or something like that, that's just not something that's within her powers. There was no indication that this was actually a threat, like, hey, P.S., if you do this again, you're going to be in trouble. It was, I have lost confidence in your judgment, in your ability to command.
Well, the way the underlying facts come out is that General Franklin had taken two actions which were within his discretion to take, which were politically unpopular. And because of that, the Secretary of the Air Force lost confidence in him. And he was given this rather draconian choice as to either resign or get fired. Why would that not have an effect on individuals who were exercising their discretion, be it General Franklin or some other convening authority in the future?
Well, let's just, Chief Judge Erdman, I'd like to address General Franklin first. Number one, you have his testimony. You have the fact that he had a long history of ignoring any kind of political pressure. We have his affidavit. He agreed to talk to the defense extensively, not just in this case, but in other cases, and that was in the record. There was an affidavit about those interviews. He provided testimony in a different case right after the Wilkerson case where he said, quote, the fact that this was with respect to clemency, but he said, I've got to do the right thing. I'm a man of integrity. In every case, I'm going to make the right call based on the facts and based on what I see, regardless of any impacts on me. Now, this was testimony that he gave. The second convening authority, which is another important point on this case, the second convening authority, who, by the way, took over after General Franklin, but before trial started, who could have taken the charges back if he didn't agree with General Franklin, he also said the same thing in a defense interview on a different case. That's in Appellate Exhibit 32. That's not actually in the joint appendix. I apologize for that, Your Honor. But he said, with respect to any political influence, quote, it's not even in my mind, not even in my calculus when making military judges' decisions. And what military justice decisions? And the military judge in this case actually made a finding of fact with respect to this. That's on the joint appendix, page 369. The military judge made a specific finding of fact, which was reviewed by this court under a clearly erroneous standard. He said, quote, the evidence shows that the convening authorities take their position seriously and will take action even though they know that doing so will cause great interest and possibly have a negative impact on their career.
Well, surely you don't think that they can basically shield the decision of the convening authority from our review for UCI by saying that there wasn't any UCI.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. No,
because that's basically what that finding of fact does, right? I mean, it's a finding of fact masquerading as it's a conclusion of law, really masquerading as a finding of fact. I have a different question to ask you, if you don't mind, which is there are some questions that we asked of appellant's counsel regarding Article 37.
Yes, ma'am.
And its applicability to an action by the Secretary of the Air Force. You would agree that that she's not a convening authority in this case, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And she's also not subject to the chapter?
Correct, Your Honor.
So under what, and I'm asking, do you have a position as to whether or not she can nonetheless be an actor in UCI, meaning can her actions, no matter how egregious or how pointed, cause unlawful command influence? And I'm not asking about the President. I'm asking about the Secretary of the Air Force, though there may be applications beyond her, depending on your answer.
Yes, Judge Ryan. So I think your concurrence in the Hutchins opinion is helpful here. This court has a long history of finding that even civilian authorities under the Estrada case, for example, in 1957, are subject to Article 37. The government did want to highlight, though, that within the strict text of Article 37, technically they don't fall under Article 37. But as the chief judge, the former chief judge, pointed out in his dissenting opinion in the Hutchins case, pointed out, even if this court says, well, technically you're not in the Article 37 realm, there's going to be a due process concern. But the question there then for the government, and the government would ask the court perhaps that if it feels like this is a necessary question, how does that impact the burden of proof? Because the Biagazi case, the Salyer case, many of the recent cases have the standard laid out, but the question is it the same burden of proof then for the government to rebut that beyond a reasonable doubt if we're talking about due process? Because in pretrial publicity, for example, due process, it would be under 905 Charlie, RCM 905 Charlie, that it would be a preponderance burden for the appellant to assert it and then the appellant to meet that burden of proof. So that would be the big question if we take it outside of Article 37. But the government's always going to be reluctant to tell this court to overturn 60 years of precedent.
I mean, that's my question. If we have 60 years of precedent, where, well, clearly people like this do not fall squarely within the ambit of Article 37, the court has treated them as that they've applied that sort of analysis. Similarly, if someone had, like, every reporter in the world said this person is guilty, right, and present, you shouldn't give them clemency, or they should be nailed to the ground with a bunch of stakes. They don't fall under Article 37, but we can nonetheless find that they didn't get a fair trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, is that the analysis?
Well, it's been the analysis, Your Honor. But again, in the Supreme Court in a case, I believe it was Justice Ginsburg wrote specifically it was a case in the 90s, and let me get the cite here, from Ratzlaff v. United States. She said, quote, "We do not resort to legislative history to cloud statutory text that is clear." So the question is for this court whether or not it wants to continue down that line of cases essentially saying that we're not in Article 37 realm textually, we're still going to apply it to folks even though the language isn't there. But again, no matter what, the government isn't going to get up and argue that a civilian cannot ever, in any circumstance,
you're not gonna
UCI.
You're not going to argue that the Secretary of the Air Force could tell all the commanders, every single person that's accused must be convicted.
Absolutely not,
getting,
Your Honor.
Or you're getting booted.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And it would be in this case if she had called up, or through the CSAF had called General Franklin and said, hey, if you don't refer the Boyce case, you're going to be fired. In that case, that would be UCI. But that's not what happened here. In fact, there's no indication, and although intent isn't dispositive, there's no indication whatsoever that the Secretary of the Air Force knew anything about the case before this court.
I mean, he'd essentially been fired by the time he took the decision to refer this case, correct?
He submitted his retirement paperwork that day, Your Honor.
I mean, he'd been told they've lost confidence. She's lost confidence in you, and submitted his retirement.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes. And I do want to highlight to this court a couple of facts
just
about
this. Just before go on, I just want to put a fine point on what Judge Ryan's line of questioning gets to. So the government is conceding that the Secretary of the Air Force can commit UCI, both actual and apparent.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, under a due process. If you're going to go with the strict text of Article 37, then it would be under a due process analysis. But then the question is it a burden? Whose burden is it to meet? But the big question, or the big fact that the government does want to point out, though, is the Secretary of the Air Force may have been concerned with decisions surrounding the Wilkerson and Wright cases. That is, the lack of the meeting with the victim, even though the regulation indicated that should happen. In the Wilkerson case, the fact that General Franklin got personally involved and wrote an 8-page memo to justify his decision, and then in the memo he said, I made my decision partly based on the fact that he was a doting father and family man, and then 2 months later, I believe this is in Appellate Exhibit 3, or in Joint Appendix 371, at Attachment 55, the story broke that Wilkerson, lo and behold, was having another relationship outside of his marriage, had a love child, and was flying his jet around to meet her. So the idea that the Secretary of the Air Force cannot somehow act based on the judgments around a decision would severely limit her authority. So it's not necessarily the decisions themselves. And if you look at the Wright decision, actually, the Wright decision, the staff judge advocate recommended in the Article 34 advice that the case not go forward, or that the charges weren't that the evidence wasn't sufficient to sustain the charges, which essentially bound General Franklin's hands. He had no choice but not to refer that case. So we know that the Secretary's actions weren't just based on the outcome of that case. It was based on the facts surrounding it, and as well as the Wilkerson case.
Okay, tell me what the government's position is. Why isn't this? Why wouldn't this appear to John Q. Public to be unlawful command influence on these facts as reported in the press and so forth? What, tell me why it wouldn't be.
One of the big facts, as I mentioned before, is the fact that the disinterested member of the public, knowing all of the facts, would know that the Secretary didn't try and attempt to affect this case because the Secretary simply didn't know about it. Number two.
Do we know that?
Well, there's no indication whatsoever that that's
there's
the
nothing
case.
In the record either
there's
way,
in the
is
record,
there?
Your Honor.
So no, we don't know that.
Well, you know to the extent that there's nothing in the record.
There's
Honor.
Nothing in the record one way or the other as to what she knew or what she didn't know about this case.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. And there's also no testimony that said that she was trying to reach down to impact this particular.
Go ahead.
So the second thing is that General Franklin himself had this long history of kind of bucking any kind of political pressure, that in this particular case, although he wasn't completely immune, he was certainly insulated to a certain degree from any kind of consequences surrounding it. The fact that every single other individual, as I stated in my introduction, was recommending referral in this case, that it wasn't a close case. There were two victims.
Major Alfred, can I go back to this notion of appearance? I think that Judge Stuckey just raised. And it seems like the record in this case raises at least arguably three perceptions or appearances. And the first would seem to be that this message being conveyed to the convening authority, Lieutenant General Franklin in this case, was retaliatory for decisions that he'd made previously. That's one appearance. Another appearance could be that by conveying this message, she was attempting to prevent him from taking any actions at all with regard to any cases from the point at which he receives the message to when he leaves the command. And then the third perception that arises, to my mind, based on this record, and I admit that I'm not the disinterested member of the public, so to speak, but the other perception that seems to arise is this chilling effect over the Air Force military justice system. In fact, over all other convening authorities who might get the message, and the message is straighten up and fly right, to coin a phrase from a song I once heard. And so at some point, aren't you, if you agree with those perceptions, and you may not, but let's assume for the sake of argument that those three perceptions or appearances arise from this record, then are we not approaching the point where I think in United States versus Cruz, this court said, you have now reached a point where there's an intolerable strain on the military justice system that simply must be ameliorated or must be addressed or remedied in some fashion. All right, now I'll tell you, I know that's a lot, and I don't like to talk a lot, but having said that, what do you think of that reasoning? And I'm not saying it's mine necessarily. I'm just saying that this is kind of what rises from the record. What do you think about that?
Well, Judge Sparks, I sent in a request for supplemental citation mm-hmm. to this court, and that was the National Defense Authorization Act of 2014. Mm-hmm. I think that takes away any kind of notion of actual or appearance of unlawful command influence. That was signed by the president the day before this phone call. And what that act says is if your staff judge advocate is recommending referral, which the staff judge advocate was, then and the convening authority elects not to make a referral decision, then the case is automatically referred to the SECAF for a disposition decision. Any reasonable member of the public looking at this case from the outside in is going to know that the SECF had zero kind of incentive to influence this case or any future case or any convening authority, because by statute now, any case is going to end up in her hands. So I think that ameliorates a lot of the concern. But even viewing this, if you assume that this is unlawful command influence, there's still going to be the prejudice analysis, which in Salyer, contrary to what the appellant says, even with the parent UCI, there's going to be a prejudice analysis. That's from the Salyer case where the chief judge then said, having found an appearance of UCI, we now test for prejudice. Unlike Salyer and Lewis, there was no advantage to the government here. Franklin was not off the case. General Franklin was not off the case. Had he been, had he passed this case to his successor, I guarantee you the appellant would be complaining, you deprived us of the most bomb-proof convening authority in the Air Force. There was no advantage to the government. In fact, the appellant argues on page 5 of his reply brief that they were deprived of the ability to have Franklin in clemency. So which is it? Is it you think he was unfair for referral, or was it in clemency? And finally, this court looks at, under the Campos case, the full and open litigation. This was litigated extensively at trial. So all the facts were out, including General Franklin, General Eberhardt, and everything. All the facts, they both said they were, and I see I'm out of time.
You can certainly respond.
Thank you.
I have a question.
And so all of the facts that came out on the record were available to the public, and they knew that these two convening authorities, two general officers, these are not just perfunctory statements or statements from subordinates like a captain or a major. These are general officers who said, I stake my reputation, I'm swearing that I was not impacted in any way. And the public sees that, and they know that these convening authorities will make the right decision, just as the military judge found, even knowing that they may suffer some kind of political consequences down the road. And if there are no further questions,
there are further questions.
Yes, sir.
First of all, as an aside, the record isn't as perfect as you assert. We don't know what she, the secretary, knew. We don't know what the contents of the phone call to the chief of staff were, et cetera. But that's not my question. My question is the reverse of the cosmic question I ask appellants. You know, I went up all the way to the president. Now, to quote Judge Sparks, if we pass on this kind of thing, are we then subjecting the military justice system to an intolerable strain, to an unacceptable level of political influence? And remember, the armed forces have to be politically neutral.
Yes, Judge.
And nothing more so than running this system.
That's a very important political consideration just overall.
Okay, well,
but
comment.
I would say I refer to the SECAF's assignment authority as plenary. Maybe that was a misnomer because it isn't completely unbounded. The president, the secretary of defense, all of our political appointees are always going to be subject to due process concerns. So they do so when they make these decisions. They do so at their own peril because they can still be subject to unlawful command influence, and this court has the supervisory authority to check that power. Our argument, though, is that in this case, under these facts, when the SECF had no idea about the appellant's case, that there was no actual or apparent unlawful command influence, not a bit. And the military judge found that, and that was based on the record, Your Honor.
So with this hypothetical disinterested observer, we assume that they're all knowing. Here, we've got Lieutenant General Franklin saying words to the effect that he recognized there could be a perception. And then he takes action. He was only in that job for 4 more weeks. He could have either just deferred it until the next person came on board, or he could have kicked it up. Should it cause concern on the part of that disinterested observer that Lieutenant General Franklin didn't have any gun to his head to make a decision, regardless of what that decision might be, but that he chose to make a decision?
I think the fact is that no matter what happened on that phone call, the SECAF didn't remove his authority immediately. And the disinterested observer would know that General Franklin checked with the staff judge advocate. He said, I was concerned myself about possibly the appearance of UCI. And he even said Some people may harbor doubts, but that's not the standard. It's significant doubts about the fairness of the proceeding. He hung on to that case for probably longer than any convening authority would hang on to a case because he said, I read everything, I looked at everything, I consulted with my SJA, and I made that referral decision. And again, this is a decision, a referral decision, that is probable cause. The standard's very low. All of his subordinate commanders, this happened, all of their advice happened before the phone call. They were all recommending it. There were two victims in the case. This appellant had an Article 15 beforehand. The objective disinterested observer would actually be more surprised if he hadn't referred the case, Your Honor.
One more question.
Yeah, just one last question. In looking at what the disinterested observer would think, do we look at the strength of the government's case or the strength of the evidence, the things that General Franklin would have looked at, or is that irrelevant?
Well, that's where it's difficult to say, Your Honor, because the case law, all of the case law, the Biagese, everything within the last 20 years says you look at the proceeding or the trial. So if you look at that, I mean, he was acquitted of offenses. He wasn't given a punitive discharge. He was given clemency by the third convening authority. So if you do, if this court opens its aperture on what it looks at, then it's certainly a fair case. But even looking at referral, it's a fair case too. But I don't know what the answer is to that, Your Honor, based on the current state of the law. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll hear rebuttal. Counsel, in your initial arguments, the court went after a particular issue, and we spent most of our time on that issue. So in light of that, and in light of the fact that we've been a little flexible here on the time constraints, we'll give you some additional time to make your major points that you had wanted probably to make in your initial arguments.
I'll make those points in responding to the government.
Okay.
And that said, you know, the government, I appreciate, points out the military judge's finding of fact. And Judge Sparks, I think this could goes to your question about you asked whether there's apparent command influence. The military judge actually made a finding of fact that the convening authorities handling of the cases in U.S. versus Wilkerson and Wright played a significant, if not exclusive, role in the Air Force's threat to fire and ultimate removal of the convening authority. The military judge made a finding of fact, or found there was apparent UCI. The military judge's finding of fact certainly creates, you know, the environment that's not, you know, his finding of fact shows there's UCI. What we ask this court to look at is that the government also spoke about how the Secretary of the Chief of Staff of the Air Force did not know who Boyce was. Well, first off, we don't know if that's true or not. But there is a nexus here, right? There's a nexus between the threat to fire for his handling of the previous sexual assault cases that the military judge found and the class of case of Boyce, sexual assault offenses, and also the temporal proximity to receiving that right after the moments after receiving the threat to fire, then receiving the Boyce case. And, you know, the government gave a good speech about the judge's, the general's affidavit, and, you know, believe what he says. The general's not the bad guy here. What he says, you know, by no means are we saying, you know, he's not telling the truth. He probably believes exactly what he said. But that's the problem in this case, and this court is constantly be concerned about, as far as, you know, United States versus Gurlitch, is that people in this situation, we can't really rely, given the nature of the influence, we can't really rely on what they have to say. And the thing is, dude, the community authority was actually influenced, right? He did things differently. He took it home. He sat on it. He discussed with his wife what to do. I mean, there was concern there. And, you know, given the military judge's finding that... because you're concerned, sir, and you're thinking about it.
But you can't get away from the fact that all of his subordinates recommended that there be a referral.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. But the, you know, as this court stated in Rivera, you know, the convening authority has the unhampered judicial discretion to determine the type of tribunal which shall try the case, or whether it should be tried at all. And those are nothing but recommendations. He has a judicial function that he's acting in that the chief of staff either actually or apparent unlawful command influence affected his decision.
Is there some piece of evidence that the general would have looked at that, in your view, should have made him say, "Oh, this is a silly case. It clearly shouldn't be referred." Do you understand what I'm saying? Is there some exculpatory piece of information somewhere within the case file that the general would have reviewed prior to his determination that it should be referred?
Your Honor, obviously the effect.
Do you understand the question?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. Specifically, no, except it's also not the slam dunk the government claims it is. I mean, he was acquitted of four specifications, one of the sexual assault offense. He didn't receive a punitive discharge. This isn't just a slam dunk offense, whereas I don't know what he saw specifically I can now give to you. In this type of situation, that is the problem, as this court found in Slayer and Lewis, is that the effects-based prejudice analysis is different, is tough in this situation. But I will keep in mind, too, is that based off the military judge's finding, why was the convening authority threatened to be fired? The government had the improper goal in that situation. They have other means. They can withhold authority. There are proper means to deal with this situation. But because of his past handling of the sexual assault cases, they didn't want that to happen again. By threatening to fire the CA, the convening authorities, leaders prevented him from taking favorable action in sexual assault cases. To this end, they achieved their goal by forcing him to abdicate his independent judgment in the performance of his court-martial duties.
So in future cases, let's say the message perceived out there is that if you're a general court-martial convening authority and you don't do what the Secretary of the Air Force wants you to do in regard to these cases, you're going to be fired or forced to retire. How would we distinguish those future cases from this case in terms of analyzing whether there was actual or apparent UCI?
I understand your question correctly, Your Honor. The law has changed. I mean, there's things that there are tools out there that the government has to shape the political landscape. And say this the right way. For instance, the change of the law now, the convening authority does not have the ability to throw out a case at this level at this time. They had other tools to pull it up. So in this situation. I don't necessarily think that would happen in the future because of the proper steps the government's taken to change the law to their will. I think the shorter way to answer the question is the law has changed now to where the government, in a proper way, opposed to the government's will in this way. It's the means they used to achieve their end was through unlawful command influence.
Mr. Trishman, do you agree with the government's, and you probably don't, but the government's view about the remedial events, so to speak, that took place that would have ameliorated either any actual attempt by the Secretary or any appearance of unlawful influence? And what they pointed out to was the National Defense Authorization Act provision for FY14 provisions, and they pointed to the fact that a new convening authority came in before the case actually went to trial, and that convening authority presumably could have taken different action, ordered another look at the situation, withdrew the charges, and possibly re-referred them himself. I think that's some of what the government was getting at. Do you agree that those
absolutely
would have ameliorated?
Absolutely disagree, Your Honor. No, that's one of the problems with this case that separates it from Judge Ryan, your concerns and the Slayer dissent about remedial action being taken. No remedial action was taken in this case. In the United States versus Viral cited in Lewis, the court stated the proper remedy for this situation is a new referral by a proper convening authority, a non-influenced convening authority. That didn't happen here. To the extent that this the military judge said he allowed extensive voir dire as a remedy, that idea is misplaced. This court in Lewis stated that the remedial actions must have a common thread and that they address the unique circumstances of UCI issues individually and that they remedy the specific harm. Extensive voir dire does not have anything to do with the unlawful command influence that occurred in the referral process.
But would it change your view if the convening authority had in fact re-referred the case, the new convening authority?
Your Honor, in fact,
you know what I mean?
No, absolutely.
Would it make a difference?
The remedy we request in this is that it's dismissal with prejudice given the high nature of the level of the threat. The alternative,
I'm not talking about.
We do request that would have been the correct fix in this situation, would have been to allow a new convening authority to.
Well, you don't have to allow. The fact of the matter is that a new convening authority came on the scene, did he not?
He not through the referral process, Your Honor. He didn't refer the case.
Right, but you're saying the fact that he didn't re-refer is some of the problem, but then you would be suggesting, I think, that he too was influenced. Maybe he was, I don't know. But is that your position, that since he did not re-refer the case to trial and start all over, that somehow the taint or infection, shall we say, I don't like to use that word, but remained, and that no other actions taken by anyone else ameliorated the appearance that was left?
That's correct, Your Honor. The key component of the military justice system is an independent convening authority acting in the judicial function of whether or not, in their independent judgment, whether to refer a case or not free from influence. And that never happened in this case.
Counsel, would you like to briefly conclude now?
Your Honor, the appellate requests dismissal with prejudice as this situation strikes at the heart of what it means to have a credible military justice system. And that's ultimately what this case is about. Any further questions, Your Honor?
No. That's it. The court thanks counsel for both parties. The case is submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:35.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:35.